This is a CBC podcast. Are you lost on the seas of changing technology? Let Bandwidth be your guide. Every week, host Anjuman Idem Seti examines the larger stories behind our ever-evolving digital landscape. Download the podcast at cbc.ca/podcasting.
Welcome to Maritime Noon. I'm Norma Lee McLeod. RCMP late charges in the case of a Nova Scotia man who died after taking prescription drugs at a party.
The autopsy showed absolutely nothing. He was healthy as a horse. Just one small choice ended his life and opportunities forever.
We get reaction from the family. Why young teachers are striking out on the job market.
Wow, 6 years of university and I'm just working as a grocery clerk because I can't get into my profession.
Are we training too many teachers?
This is huge business for the oversupply of universities we have here in Nova Scotia.
If you're looking for a teaching job and having no luck, share your thoughts. This is Maritime Noon. Time to talk. There is a major development today in the case of a Nova Scotia man who died after taking prescription drugs at a party in Berwick in Nova Scotia's Annapolis Valley. The RCMP have charged 22-year-old Kyle Fredericks with criminal negligence causing death and trafficking in a controlled substance. It's all in relation to the death of Joshua Graves. Amy Graves is Joshua's sister. She spoke out about her brother's death at a public meeting in Berwick, Nova Scotia, last year.
My brother Josh, who turned 21 November 2nd, had just moved home from Alberta in February. I had had my son last December, and he wanted to be home to watch him grow up. He had a great job that he loved. He had just bought a new car and was looking into getting a mortgage. He was truly on top of the world. Friday, March 18th, 2011, he decided to go to a house party and have some beers. Apparently, there were more than beers at this house party. There were Dilaudid. People say Josh used these pills along with other people at the party. Josh went home that night, though. He fell asleep and he never woke up. He was found the next day. The autopsy showed absolutely nothing. He was healthy as a horse. Just one small choice ended his life and opportunities forever.
That's Amy Graves. She went on to form a group called Get Prescription Drugs Off the Streets. She also filed a formal complaint against the RCMP, saying that officers failed to conduct a thorough investigation into her brother's death. Today, as charges are laid, the RCMP are acknowledging a complaint led to new information and resulted in today's charges. We reached Amy Graves at her home in the Annapolis Valley. Hello, Amy.
Hi.
How are you feeling about the fact that charges have been laid?
I feel amazing, like a huge weight has just been lifted off my shoulders.
You know, you complained about the initial police investigation where no charges were laid, and now there are charges because your complaint had the RCMP taking another look. If you hadn't complained, would anything have happened?
No, I fought with the RCMP. I called them for days asking them why they couldn't just interview the people from the party. Nobody was interviewed. No evidence was taken. That was the issue I had, is that I knew there was so much information and I knew there was so much evidence, but nobody would take the time to look at it. They said that it was Josh's choice and they're, you know, kind of like, too bad, so sad. And after filing my complaint, they were then forced to look at the information and, you know, all the evidence and statements that I had from people who attended the party.
And we have the charges today.
Yes.
What did you learn from this about the consequences for people selling drugs?
It blows my mind. People, because it's a drug, feel like I got the feeling that Josh deserved it. If you're drinking and driving and you have someone in the car and you crash and the passenger dies and you live, you can be held accountable. But for some reason, drug dealers have been allowed to get off the hook. There's no consequence to their action. I know Josh made a bad choice, but there has to be consequences for the other people breaking the law, or else there is no fear. They'll just keep doing what they're doing.
You know, you've said that you wanted Joshua's death to create awareness and change, and you've done so much to try to do that. You've been lobbying for more control on prescription drugs and more help for addicts. Any progress?
Oh, definitely. It actually scares me to think if Josh hadn't have passed away a year ago and this hadn't happened, I can't imagine what the state of the valley would be in, how many more people and friends I would have lost, and how little treatment. There probably would be no Annapolis Valley Health methadone clinic. There would probably still be hundreds of people on a waiting list.
These are all things that you lobbied for and got responses to.
Yes, not just me, but me and others in my community. But definitely Josh was like the driving force and, you know, the motivation to keep going and to make a change so there wouldn't be any more Joshes.
Now, you've been very vocal in your community, and a lot of people are not willing to do that after a death like this in their family. Has it divided the community, or do you feel the community is behind what you're doing?
It's definitely divided. I've lost a lot of friends.
Why did you lose friends? Why do you think that happened?
Because people were kind of forced to take sides. Not that they were forced, but it's kind of either it's something you agree with or you don't agree with. And there's a lot of people that feel, I don't know, it's where it's coming from, too. A lot of the negative feedback I get, of course, people who are still using and abusing pills, people who deal themselves, people who are diverting prescriptions, and then they get cut off, and I get an angry email saying, you know, all because of you, I got my OxyContin or my Dilaudid or my methadone cut off. And really, the negative response just goes to show me that what I'm doing is having some effect, because I didn't go into this to make friends. I went into this to make change. So it's kind of like, I feel if you're not with me, you're against me. And it's not like that, but there's just no in-between. It's just such a touchy subject with me just because of my brother, you know. It was hard for me to see friends of my brother that had been friends of his whole life, after his death, still hanging out with these people, still going to these parties, still continuing the same behavior they were doing before. And I think that was the hardest for me, is that in terms of his social circle, I never really saw a change in them. I saw a huge change in my community, which is amazing, and, you know, so much support. But the people that were really close to Josh, and I really wanted this to, you know, have their light bulb moment, it just still to this day has never occurred.
So your fight's not over yet.
No, and there's never going to be an end. It's hopefully going to get better, easier, and, you know, it's not going to be such an intense battle, but I can't see this going away anytime soon.
All right, Amy, good luck. Thanks so much for taking our call today.
Thank you. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
We reached Amy Graves at her home in the Annapolis Valley, Nova Scotia. And we'd like to hear from you on this. Tell us how prescription drug abuse has affected you or your family, and whether the help you need has been available. Our number is 1-800-565-5463. You can leave a message there on our answering machine or email us, marnoon@cbc.ca.
You're listening to Maritime Noon on CBC Radio 1 in Fort McMurray, Alberta, on the internet at cbc.ca/maritimenoon.
Not enough jobs. That's a common complaint in the Maritimes. And it's hitting home for new teachers in the region who graduate only to find they can't break into their chosen field. Judith Reeson has experienced that disappointment firsthand. She's been working as a substitute teacher for the Eastern School District in PEI for the past 5 years. She says that wasn't exactly what she had in mind when she started her career.
Well, when I graduated in 2005, I thought I would have to work on the substitute list for a few years. Within 5 years, I had hoped to become a full-time teacher, but that didn't happen at all. I've only had one contract, and it doesn't look like there's much coming up.
Judith Reeson says a contract is out of reach and she can't get even enough days as a substitute teacher to make a decent living. She says she's averaging about 100 days of work a year out of 195 school days, not nearly enough for her.
I think it's very tough to get a job on a daily basis as a substitute teacher here on the island. But the only window I have to what the competition is a new computerized system called ASOP, which you go on as a substitute and you click to find out what jobs are available. I have clicked on that program for months now, and I never find a job. I've even heard of one poor fellow wrote in and talked about how he would get all of his family to look on ASOP for jobs all day long for him, and he still wasn't working much. I've met a couple of substitutes who told me they worked 2 or 3 days a month and they didn't know what to do. There are a lot of people who aren't really existing on their substitute salary and they have to take extra jobs. And what's hard about that is sometimes the extra job demands that you go during school time. So how on earth are you going to get the experience of a teacher if you are working, you know, in a bank or in a grocery store or something to supplement your income? You're just not going to get there. And then all of a sudden you're faced with the prospect of, wow, 6 years of university and I'm just working as a grocery clerk because I can't get into my profession.
Judith Reeson says we are training too many new teachers in the Maritimes and that something needs to change. Well, today we're asking what you think. Are we training too many teachers? Are we giving Maritimers false hope by accepting them into our teacher programs? Maybe you're a recent grad and you're having trouble finding work. We'd like to know what your experience has taught you. So call us now. The number here is 1-800-565-1940. If you're in the Halifax area, 420-9336. I'm also watching for your emails today, marnoon@cbc.ca, or tweet us at CBC Maritime Noon. And once again, we're asking, are we training too many teachers? I have two guests with me today. Anne Sherman is Dean of the Faculty of Education at the University of New Brunswick in Fredericton, and Robert Berard teaches in the Faculty of Education at Mount St. Vincent University in Halifax. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for being with us. Robert, first to you, the question, are we training too many teachers in the Maritimes?
I think that we're certainly licensing more teachers than we have ever before, and there are certainly not nearly enough jobs in the region for the number of teachers we license.
So just as the person we just heard from complained, it's a pretty dismal situation out there.
It's a very dismal situation.
Anne, do you think the problem is we're training too many teachers in the Maritimes?
I think that there are too few jobs for the number that we're training. And here at UNB, we actually decreased our enrollment this past year from 225 to 150 because of this problem. And, you know, certainly there are a number of reasons why this is happening. But the fact remains that it's very difficult for the new graduates to get a job unless they have very particular skill areas. They're a high school physics or math teacher, for example, or a French immersion teacher. They're still widely sought.
You don't need any more English teachers or social studies.
And not as many elementary teachers either.
Right. So, you know, Robert, 12 years ago, Nova Scotia tried to address this.
Yes.
Some education programs were closed, and we capped the number of teachers being trained at our schools.
That's right.
Why didn't that work? Isn't that the solution?
Well, it didn't work for a couple of reasons. In the first place, suddenly a couple of institutions opened up in Maine at Fort Kent and Presque Isle, which serve almost exclusively maritime teachers. So students who no longer had places, I mean, for example, in 1994, Nova Scotia was graduating 1,150 teachers a year at the various institutions. After the rationalizations done by the Savage government, the number was reduced from 1,150 to just over 400.
That's a huge cut.
It's a huge cut.
And then schools opened in Maine.
Schools opened in Maine, or students would go to other provinces and pursue their degrees there, or even go to Australia or some other place. And but they were they often came back to Nova Scotia or to New Brunswick to do their practice teaching, and were licensed. And what the result is that in this past year, we're now issuing more licenses than we did in 1994.
So you're way back to where you started.
Way back to where we started. But in Nova Scotia, in terms of the number of teachers we train here, that number has not gone up significantly.
And what happened in your area? It's because you don't have the cap like Nova Scotia does.
That's right.
But you voluntarily reduced some positions at your school.
At UNB Fredericton we did, but it is different here than in Nova Scotia in that the New Brunswick government does not set a cap on our programs. It's up to each institution. So while we cut our enrollment, a couple of others can't afford to cut theirs. And another university that's a private university increased its enrollment. And so it's really up to the individual institution.
What do you mean others can't afford to cut theirs?
The BED program, pays well for itself. All the costs are covered more so than in some other degree programs. And at UNB, we're the only institution that offers an English master's program, a complete master's degree. So while I'm able to cut the numbers in the BED, I'm able to increase the enrollment in the master's degree, and so my budget still balances. St. Thomas doesn't have that luxury. They only offer the BED program, and so if they cut their program, they've cut a lot of their funding, and it's very difficult for them to decrease their enrollment.
So to make the right decision, perhaps for the size of the job, the number of jobs available, you hurt the university.
It would definitely hurt the university. On the other hand, we have to consider that someplace like St. Thomas only offers the program to 90 students. They have a very good program that's, for a discrete number of students. Ours is probably the second largest with the 150. But a place like Crandall has more students than we do. But one of the primary focuses at that university is the BED program.
All right, so we've sort of laid out what's going on in terms of numbers, and we're asking our listeners today, are we training too many teachers? And we have callers on the line who want to weigh in on this and tell their stories. We're going to go to Karen Congdon first in Sackville, New Brunswick. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
Hi. So your daughter is a teacher?
My daughter is a teacher who had a contract in Sackville, New Brunswick, and moved to Ontario. And this past year, she has not been in the classroom once.
And this is in Ontario?
This is in Ontario. You think it's bad here. Up there, they keep churning the teachers out. And up there, you're competing, as you are competing down here, with retirees.
Tell me about that. What do you mean? They're substituting?
You can be retired, and you can substitute.
And that's preventing...
That's allowed. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, some of the retirees will, because they have retire 1 year and go back into the same school the next year as a substitute.
Well, I've heard that complaint in the Maritimes, too, even though this is happening to your daughter in Ontario. Robert, yep. Do you want to address that? I mean, is this happening on a regular basis?
Yes, it is. The government and the school boards and the teachers' unions have agreed to cap the number of days retired teachers can substitute. But the argument's often been made that unless they guaranteed these teachers a certain number of substitute days, they wouldn't retire in the first place.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think of that?
It's very difficult for new teachers.
Yeah. Go ahead, Karen.
I'm sorry. How many days are they allowed to? What's the cap at?
I don't know the cap, but they did have to put a cap on it.
It's over 100 in Ontario, and I think it's close to 95 or 100 here.
That may well be true.
And Karen, do you think that's fair?
No.
But now, from a parent's perspective, you might want the more experienced teacher at the head of your child's class.
Well, any teacher I've talked to that has not gone back into the classroom has left everything in the classroom.
Yes.
Like when they retire, they're ready to retire.
Right.
You know, and it's like, no, or they'll go into, if they were a high school teacher, they'll go elementary.
So, So Anne, do you think that this is a problem, that schools should stop hiring retired teachers to do sub work?
Well, it makes for greater competition for the new teachers, but as Robert said, Many teachers wouldn't retire unless they knew they had that chance at extra income, because that's part of the problem we're facing. People who graduated with me, for example, back in 1977 or 78, are eligible for retirement now that we're all old enough, and if they've worked most of the time, they would have enough years to retire. But because of the economic situation, their incomes or their investments, aren't growing the way that they thought, or they may have lost a great deal of their investment money, and they end up staying in the school for 3, 4, 5 years longer than they had originally planned. Some will retire because they know they do get those extra substitute days. So I think on balance, at least by having them retire, that's opened up another position in the school to hire a new teacher.
Karen, it's frustrating your daughter, obviously.
Well, she had, like I said, she had a license here, but she actually had a retired teacher who was working on both sides of the border in Ontario tell her that she'd have to go to Quebec, and this teacher was working 3 and 4 days a week, and she couldn't get one. And what about in New Brunswick here, where you can take a university graduate and put them in the classroom, and what they graduate is not with an education degree?
Yeah, in certain instances, that's true. Some very small rural communities where teachers with a license and a degree prefer not to go and live, have to create special licensing conditions for people who have a degree but not a teacher's license. And
Sackville, New Brunswick's not that small.
So no, but there are some places that qualified people don't want to go. Everybody seems to want to go to the large urban centers. And it's very difficult across both Nova Scotia and New Brunswick to get teachers to move to smaller towns. I think Sackville's an ideal place to live. But some of my students from Fredericton don't want to go there.
Oh, no, I understand that. I mean,
yeah, and it's
a
shame.
It is a shame. It's just that my daughter left here, went up there thinking that she could slowly do the thing again, get into the classroom, and was cut down cold. It hasn't gone into a classroom, and this is it. And now doesn't know if she can teach or not because she's been away from it.
Pretty frustrating for you and for your daughter, Karen.
Oh, well, look,
thank you for the call, and thanks for raising that issue.
All right, thank you very much.
Much appreciated. Bye-bye. We're going next to Bob Gogan in Truro, Nova Scotia. And Bob, I understand you're a retired school principal?
That's right, normally.
Hi. Do you think we're training too many teachers?
Far too many. That's the obvious problem. Either put a limit on the number of teachers each university can train, or go back to establishing a teacher training center.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And put certain stipulations on teachers who go out of province to get their training, put them on the substitute list for 4 or 5 years, or discourage them going out of province. We're just turning out far too many teachers than we can absorb in the system. That's grade 6 math.
And what do you think are the consequences of that? Besides, obviously a large pool of frustrated young people who aren't getting jobs.
We had a lot of trained teachers working for Sobeys and A&W.
Yeah. And Robert, what do you think? Are there consequences in the classroom that where the young teachers with new ideas, perhaps new methods, can't get in?
I think the system gets a little creaky when you don't have a good flow through of generations. I do want to point out that as I say, the number of teachers in Nova Scotia was limited. Initially, it was supposed to be limited a bit more, but St. FX appealed, and they managed to keep their program. And for reasons best known to themselves, the last Conservative government created another program at Cape Breton University. But still, the numbers there are still restricted. Less than 50% of the teachers licensed in Nova Scotia are trained in Nova Scotia.
There you go.
So you can't solve it all locally.
No.
Yeah. All right, Bob. Well, look, thank you for the call.
Not at all. But in the meantime, there are an awful lot of good teachers who at one time started out as substitute teachers.
Yes.
I met a few of them myself.
Yes, exactly.
Universities with their license to engage as many as they want to, they're part of the problem. And we can thank my good friend Jamie Muir for being part of that.
All right. Okay. All right, Bob. Thanks for the call.
Not at all. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye to you. We're asking today, are we training too many teachers in the Maritimes? And we're asking for you to call if you've had an experience trying to get a teaching job. Maybe someone in your family has. Tell us what you think, where you think the problem lies and what the consequences are. The number here, 1-800-565-1940, in the Halifax area, 420-9336. You can also email us, marnoon@cbc.ca. Right back to take your calls in a moment, but first, Ryan Pierce has a news update.
Hi, normally, charges of criminal negligence causing death have been laid in the overdose of a man from Nova Scotia's Annapolis Valley. Police also accused 22-year-old Kyle Fredericks of selling hydromorphone. Josh Graves died last year. Police in Fredericton say they hope to have more to say next week about the circumstances of Beth Fallow's death. Her body was found along a bank of the St. John River earlier this year. And Calgary MP Rob Anders has apologized in the House of Commons for falling asleep during a Veterans Affairs Committee meeting while veterans were talking about homelessness. Anders then lashed out when he was confronted about the 20-minute nap, accusing two of his critics of being communists, even though they are in fact Conservative Party members, and now he says he's sorry. More local news at 1 o'clock. CBC meteorologist Peter Code will be here at 5 to 1 with another look at the forecast, normally.
Thanks, Ryan. That's Ryan Pierce in the CBC newsroom. And our numbers once again, 1-800-565-1940 in Halifax, 420-9336. We're asking, are we training too many teachers? Are we giving Maritimers false hope by accepting them into our teacher programs? My guests today are Anne Sherman, Dean of the Faculty of Education at the University of New Brunswick in Fredericton, and Robert Berard from the Faculty of Education at Mount St. Vincent in Halifax. And on Twitter, Angela McKay has this comment. She says, training programs should be admitting people who will eventually fill only voids in math, science, or French immersion. Would you agree with that, Robert? If that's where the voids are.
I think that most programs really make an effort to get students to fill those positions. But at the same token, universities do not train teachers only for the local market. And certainly we tell any student coming to our program or that we talk to who's expressed an interest in the program that the situation for finding work locally is very difficult. But by the same token, the universities in Nova Scotia have a job fair every February. 35 and 40 recruiters from northern boards, western boards, the United States, England, China come to recruit teachers in all areas, including English.
But it's a good use of taxpayers' dollars to educate people who are going to teach elsewhere in the world?
I think in terms of providing a university education, we've always been a net exporter of teachers since the very beginning of teacher education in Nova Scotia. We've always exported a certain number. But in terms of the economics, one thing that I think is important to recognize is that, as I say, the numbers in Nova Scotia are capped. But Nova Scotia spends a substantial amount of money providing student loans to education students who do their degrees in Maine and in Ontario and Australia and so on. So that in fact, what we're doing is we're subsidizing students to leave the province for their training.
And do you think we should be? Should we refuse those loans?
I don't think it's a particularly good use of our money, but whether governments are constrained legally from restricting student loans for education, I don't know. I suspect that they may have legal obligations to provide those loans.
All right. Ryan Drost is on the line from Fredericton with a story for us. Hi, Ryan.
Good day.
Hi. You're trained as a teacher?
I am. I've been actually supply teaching for the past 3 years.
And so what do you think about our question today? Are we training too many teachers?
Well, I think at some point in time, as bitter as I am about not having a full-time job yet, I kind of have to take some onus on myself as well. And I think that's unfortunately the reality. I mean, I was like many English and history majors going into the education program. We all think that, we're great teachers, and it doesn't matter what the job market's like. We're going to be the one that gets the job.
Right.
But unfortunately, there are a lot of really good teachers out there on the supply list, and it's a very competitive field. So, I mean, if I could go back, and I probably would have taken a different route if I'd known that it was going to be like this. But, I mean, at the same time, I took this route, and you kind of make your bed, and you've got to lay in it, I guess. And if the thing is, limiting our education enrollment is just going to send revenue to other colleges, perhaps stateside, that aren't limiting their enrollment.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if you're if you're set on being a teacher and you're not willing to face the realities that it's a very competitive market, then there's not really a lot that you can do for that.
Ryan, was the university really clear with you about how many jobs and your likelihood of getting work when you enrolled?
I don't know if it was actually talked about, really, to be honest. I think we've all heard about, for the last 10, 15 years, about, you know, there's going to be a great... You always hear about a bunch of teachers going to be retiring and you're going to be getting jobs and stuff like that. I don't know if the university put that in my head or if I just got it from listening to different people, but I don't know.
Yeah. All right. Well, look, thanks for the call.
Yep.
We're going to take another one now from Freeman Dryden in Terrence Bay, Nova Scotia. Hi, Freeman.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, good. Are we training too many teachers?
Yes, absolutely.
And what do you think's behind it?
Well, the first thing, of course, is that it's a very competitive business for the universities because of the way we fund universities. And I have a bone to pick about that. I think the funding should go directly to the students, and they should pay what it costs to educate them. That gives them a choice, it gives them control, and it gives the government control by restricting student assistance to areas where we have a critical need.
So back on the teachers, when you say it's Anne alluded to this earlier, that there is some of that universities are protecting the money they need to run their institutions by keeping enrollment up.
Yeah. And I mean, it's just not the way to do it. It's totally backwards. But I really wanted to talk about something else, which is the retired teachers.
Yes.
You know, not all retired teachers can afford to not substitute. Mm-hmm. There are numbers of us out there, and I'm one of them, who do not have any pension. And every time we substitute, a big chunk of our substitute payment is grabbed by the pension fund, and we can never get it back unless we can put in at least 100 days a year. It's just money that's gone, and we'll never see it.
So it's not like you're just holding a place that a young person could take. You need the money, too, is what you're saying.
We need the money. Yeah. But there are lots of people out there who do not need it and are filling their pockets over on top of a pretty plush pension.
Yeah. All right, Freeman, thanks for the call.
Yeah, well, you know, the whole thing about the pensions is a very difficult thing. So that's something that needs to be kept in mind. And the specialists, okay, are the ones the schools are suffering because we can't get specialist teachers as subs.
Okay, yeah. Thanks, Freeman. Thank you. Lots of things you've raised there.
Yeah.
On the idea of the universities losing funding when they cut spaces, I mean, is there a fix for that, Robert?
I think that, again, as I say, in Nova Scotia, because our funding is based on a formula, the university gets a certain amount of money for the number of teacher education students we're supposed to have. So there's not a great incentive for us to exceed that number. But to a certain extent, university funding does follow students. In other words, if I choose to go to St. Mary's for my undergraduate degree, then St. Mary's grant is based on the number of students they have.
Okay. Anne, any thoughts on that? Is there a way around that problem?
Here, as in Nova Scotia, all the universities get a government grant. Ours isn't in education based on the number of students that we have, but the overall university grant is tied to the number of students that they have. But of course, those grants are being cut both here and in Nova Scotia every year, or being maintained while the costs go up. And so universities in general are struggling and trying not to raise tuition too much, trying to look for external funding where they can. But it's all part of a big economic story that means all the universities are struggling in the Maritimes right now. And, you know, the economic situation is such that governments just feel that they can't give us more money. We negotiate hard to get as much as we can.
So you protect the seats you have, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, Megan Norris is calling us from Halifax with her story. Hi, Megan.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. We're asking today, are we training too many teachers in the Maritimes? What do you think?
Well, it certainly feels like, or is obvious, that it's almost like a bottleneck once everyone graduates.
Your teacher?
Places. I graduated in May with my Bachelor of Education. I am not teaching right now because, from my experience, it's really, really difficult, the idea of possibly giving up a job where you have guaranteed hours, or telling them, you know, maybe only schedule me a couple days a week and then just hoping that you're going to get work substitute teaching. And that's not a situation that I feel I can put myself in right now.
So you've had to go find other work and you're not available to substitute.
Exactly.
As much.
And all of my friends who are doing a little bit of subbing, they also all have other jobs that they're trying to balance and still trying to get in and make connections and getting into the schools and meeting teachers and principals. But some of them are getting maybe 2 or 3 days a week, and I have a lot of friends who are only getting maybe that many a month. And I have a few friends in New Brunswick as well. I haven't spoken to them in a few months, but the last time I talked to them, it wasn't looking any better for them there.
Now, Megan, we've heard, though, that there are places, outlying areas, where there's lots of work for substitute teachers,
yeah,
where they're taking people without education degrees. So have you thought of moving?
I have. It is something that I would like to do. It's not feasible personally for me at the moment, but it is definitely something that I have considered. Maybe even going and, you know, living with one of my parents for a little while, because they live in smaller towns. So that is something that I've thought of. I do have a friend, or two friends in Wolfville, and they are having a little bit more luck out there with substitute teaching. But right now, living in Halifax, it is pretty difficult.
Do you think you were misled?
No, to be honest. I did my education at the Mount, and we were told many times that, you know, absolutely, to consider moving to a rural area, to consider going overseas or thinking about different ways of teaching, not just in Halifax public education system.
Yeah.
So we were told to think about all of our options. So that was good to be exposed to all sorts of different possibilities.
Well, that's it. Now, Hannah, thanks very much for the call, Megan. Hannah on Twitter has said to us that one of her clients, she says, my cousin is in education at Mount St. Vincent right now, and the class was told on day one the only jobs left are in the United Arab Emirates, so plan to move away. Is that what you're telling your students mostly?
Oh, I think I know who told them that.
Okay.
But, we do try to make very clear how difficult and how competitive teaching is in the region. The other thing that we've begun to do, since we require more practice teaching than most jurisdictions and certainly more than is required for provincial licensing, mm-hmm, we're trying to put more and more students for part of their practicum into places like Pier 21, Nova Scotia Museum, IWK Hospital.
So what are they doing there?
They're doing education-related work for which they find, for example, if they're running tours at Pier 21, they're using a number of their teaching skills to work with adults who come through. We're exploring possibilities of having students do some work at the community college, so that because what we began finding is a number of our graduates who could not find teaching jobs found their way into other types of education-related employment, found the BED valuable to them, and so what we're trying to do is build more of that into our programs now.
You have to look outside the classroom for possibilities.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think a number of the institutions are doing that. Mm-hmm. We're also sending students on practica in other countries. 11 leave next week for China, for example, where there is a lot of hiring. So that, like Robert, we're trying to find other places for our students to work.
All right. We're going to take another call from Tracy Kelleher in Quispam, CIS, New Brunswick. Hi, Tracy.
Hi there.
Hi. You graduated from teaching school when? Back in
1982.
Okay.
We're talking 30 years ago.
And were there jobs then?
There were no jobs then. It was the same situation. And I treated my degree as more or less as an arts degree. And just the fact that I had a university education, it had opened the door to learning for me. And I created my own way and had a, you know, very interesting career.
So you didn't go into the classroom?
I tried. I did do some supply teaching, but I needed to work full-time. My husband was still in school. So I did. I got involved in the business world, and I'm not saying that. I mean, I sympathize with students today, and I'm not saying it's easy, but there are all kinds of other opportunities where you can use the skills that you've just learned in university and apply it in many different ways.
And just briefly, what career did you carve out for yourself?
I actually was a sales rep for L'Oreal. I did some facilitating with New Brunswick Housing, and then I started my own business, CanadianParents.com.
So it's not what you expected, but it worked out
right
for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it worked out really well, and now I'm involved in technology and social media.
All right. Well, look, Tracy, that maybe gives some hope for some of the students who are trying to get into the classroom unsuccessfully. Thank you for the call.
You're welcome.
All right. Curtis Snyder is next in Bridgewater. Hi, Curtis.
Hi. Hello.
Hi. We're asking whether we're training too many teachers in the Maritimes. What do you think?
Yes, we definitely are. And I'm off work teaching now. I had some surgery, so I'm in a good position to comment on a couple of things. One is that I'm in a rural area, and there are way too many teachers on the sublist here. And the difference that I see is I graduated in 88 and owed $16,000. These kids today are graduating owing $56,000. And I think the universities are at best being disingenuous, not letting these kids know the actual numbers of how many students there'll be in the future versus how many substitutes there are, how many graduates there are. At worst, they're being negligent. These kids are coming in broke and owing a heck of a lot of money, and nobody at the university is laying the numbers on the table to show them the truth. And I think it's just criminal what they're not telling these kids.
Well, let's let our guests respond to that. Anne, do you want to take that on?
Yeah, I'm not sure what Curtis is referring to there. We, like Robert, first day, you know, and even when they come for us for advice about it, we're quite clear about how many have been teachers are planning to retire, numbers that we get through the New Brunswick Teachers Association. We talk about the number of teachers who were hired in their graduating class the year before. And I do want to point out that over half of our class was hired into a full-time job last year, not all in New Brunswick. But it's not everybody who's, you know, goes without a job. And so we're very clear with them. We talk about it all through their year. We talk about the alternatives. We talk about the different places they can look for work. Like Robert, we bring people in for recruiting fairs. We had people here a few weeks ago from the UK, from South Africa, from China, from Dubai, and from the northern parts of Canada. From northern Alberta. Alberta is one of the only provinces that doesn't prepare enough teachers for its needs, so we're helping our teachers look there. So we are as clear with them as we can. We can't predict the future, but we fully understand that they come in with sometimes $50,000 and $60,000 worth of student loans, and we try hard to help them find employment when they graduate.
But doesn't offering a certain number of spots imply somehow that there's work in the field?
Well, as I said earlier, that's why we've reduced our number.
Yes.
Because we had 225 and 118, I think it was, were hired. So we've reduced it to 150, knowing that about 20 to 30% simply can't leave the area. They're married here. They will want to go on the substitute list, but the others can find employment, and we work actively to help them with that.
Okay, Teresa is calling us from Sheet Harbor, Nova Scotia. Hello, Teresa.
I am. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for the call and thanks for your patience. We're asking whether we're training too many students. What do you want to tell us?
Well, I'm one of those outcasts. I went to Maine for my education degree for a few reasons. One of them is it's a shorter time period. I know they recently started offering a shorter time period in Nova Scotia at a few of the education programs, but other than that, cost of living is so much less. Tuition was less. Our dollar's doing really well. It was just the best option for me. Finishing my undergrad at Dow, I was, you know, $50,000 in debt, and I didn't want to add on too much more to that, especially knowing the teaching positions here in Halifax.
And are you working, Teresa?
I am one of the lucky few. I have a full-time job. I'm a phys ed teacher, so I'm a specialist. It's a little bit different. And I do have to travel 2.5 hours outside of the city. It's still part of Halifax, apparently, but yeah, so I'm one of the lucky ones, and I definitely feel so grateful because most of my friends have moved out west. Some have moved to, I have a friend in London, England. I have friends going up north. You know, they can't get jobs. They sub for 3-4 years, and it's depressing. you know, they make more money as a waitress than they do subbing. So.
Well, yeah, and you mentioned some of the reasons why you chose Maine, but I guess one of the problems that those classes have created is that we've lost control in the Maritimes about, you know, controlling the numbers.
Yeah,
and it's
yeah.
Okay, so how do your unemployed friends who trained in the Maritimes feel about you?
Well, some of them trained in Maine, some of them trained in Ontario because they have a one-year program as well, and a few of them did do it in Nova Scotia. But, you know, we all teach different subjects, so depending on what you're able to teach, it's a whole different ballgame. And, you know, and they're happy for me that I have a job, but they're, you know, bitter that they don't have one either. But, you know, being a specialist, I am one of those lucky people that, you know, we can get in a little bit quicker than a few others, but it's a tough game. And even when you're in, you don't know if you're in for good. You know, you could teach 4 or 5 years in a row at 100% and never know if you're going to be get a contract. You know, there's too many people not retiring, too many people staying in the system. And, you know, it's one of those things. You never know if you have a job the next year. It's just, you know, keep your fingers crossed and hope lots of people decide to retire. That's about it.
All right, Teresa, thanks for calling in, especially calling yourself an outcast and calling
in. Well, I'm one of the ones that might be frowned upon, but you know what? It was the right decision for me, and I loved my program there.
All right, thanks a lot.
No.
Okay, bye-bye. All right, as we just wrap it up, I want to know if there, you know, there were predictions not that long ago that there would be this wave of retirement, baby boomer age. Now, you both have alluded to the fact that teachers aren't necessarily making that choice. Is there any sign on the horizon of change, Robert? Do you see anything in the maybe medium term that would change the situation?
Well, one of the things that I think we have to realize is that the number of school-age students in Nova Scotia is going down. There are only two ways to increase those numbers. One way is to import people, and the other way is to create new ones, and we're not doing either of them very well. So I'm not particularly sanguine about the possibility of a huge increase in teacher numbers anytime soon. One thing I would say, one of the earlier callers was talking about how she found her degree valuable even though she never actually taught and went into sales. And I think it's probably worth the listeners knowing that Premier Dexter has a BED from Dalhousie University, and I'm sure it made him the man he is today.
Mm-hmm. Interesting point. Okay. What about any long-term, medium-term hope, Anne?
I'm eternally hopeful. And, you know, I do see a talk in Fredericton of a number of people retiring next year. And we're in one of the few areas in New Brunswick where the population's growing. Parts of the northern regions in New Brunswick are the population's decreasing there. So the three larger urban centers, the population is growing. And if retirements keep up, there will be some jobs. And again, you know, we continue to talk about whether or not we should hold at 150 as an enrollment or decrease again. We have an agreement with the university that as soon as jobs increase, we can increase our enrollment. But we're conscious of this all the time and talk about it on a weekly basis. So it's certainly something that we're always aware of.
All right, I want to thank you both for being with us today. Interesting discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My guests have been Anne Sherman, the Dean of the Faculty of Education at University of New Brunswick in Fredericton, and Robert Berard from the Faculty of Education at Mount St. Vincent University in Halifax. You can still have your say on whether we're training too many teachers. Tell us your stories. 1-800-565-5463 will get you our answering machine. You can email us, marnoon@cbc.ca, and we have an interesting conversation about this going on our Twitter feed too. So you can tweet us and have a look at CBC Maritime Noon. end, we have a bit of advice now from a listener who was following our conversation with dog behavior expert Sylvia Jay yesterday. Sylvia had this advice for a dog owner whose Shih Tzu is out of sorts for days after visiting the groomer.
I would try to find the gentlest and most patient and kindest groomer that you can find. And I would do that immediately after she's been groomed so that you have some time between the next grooming.
That's dog behavior expert Sylvia Jay. Dog groomer Michelle Young heard the question and wanted to help out. And she wrote this email. She says, it's very common for dogs to shake and shiver and attach themselves to you when you take them to a groomer. Most dogs are happy with the groomer, but not as happy with what the groomer does, bathing, nail trims, etc. I would comment, in addition to finding a gentle groomer, to also look closely at your reaction to what the dog is doing. If the dog is shaking or clinging to you, don't tell them it's okay or become upset. You are only reaffirming this behavior. When you drop the dog off, be positive and confidently leave the dog with the groomer. In my experience, 99% of the time, dogs immediately stop the behaviors once the owners are out of sight. Also, when you pick your dog up, don't make a big deal out of him or coddle him. Try to make grooming a regular part of your day. So our thanks to Michelle Young for that advice. Remember, if you want to get in touch with us about anything you hear on the program, here's how: 1-800-565-5463 or email us marnoon@cbc.ca.
Hi, you're listening to Maritime Noon at 97.9 FM in Niguac, Nouveau Brunswick.
And we'll check in with CBC meteorologist Peter Cote now with a look ahead at our maritime forecast. Hi, Peter.
Good afternoon, Norma Lee. Well, we've got about 50-50 split between fair weather and some light snow. We do have some light snow being reported in some parts of southern New Brunswick, but that really won't amount to anything. It's more or less some flurry activity that will clear later this afternoon. I do expect to see the sunshine throughout New Brunswick later this afternoon. The other is a disturbance, though, passing by to the south of Cape Breton on its way to the island of Newfoundland and Labrador, and that is going to be giving some snow to, mostly to Cape Breton and Richmond County. It's showing up very close to Guysborough County right now, just offshore, but that could give a few centimeters of snow, as well as blowing snow, because it's a sort of an intensifying system, so we'll see the wind out of the north gusting at times to 60 and 70 kilometers an hour in Cape Breton. Back on the mainland, it's just cloudy with some sunny breaks and a few flurries. However, I'm still anticipating the mild temperatures moving in. By tomorrow, we'll see afternoon readings into the mid-single digits pretty much throughout all three maritime provinces. And then on Thursday, I'm looking for temperatures in the low teens in New Brunswick, and we'll likely hit that in the Annapolis Valley of Nova Scotia as well. Temperatures around 12 or 13 degrees. Still sunny as well. However, on Friday, that's when we get wet, and that's when we see our weather change. It's going to be windy with periods of rain. Clearing conditions can be expected in New Brunswick, but all leading into a mostly sunny Sunday throughout all three maritime provinces. A sunny weekend, throughout all three maritime provinces normally.
Well, with those temperatures and that rain, what snow we have left may not last for long.
I think that too, yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Tom.
That's CBC meteorologist Peter Cote. Tomorrow here on Maritime Noon, 1 in 10 Canadians can't afford the drugs that they've been prescribed. In some cases, they're actually choosing between drugs and food, and their health, of course, is suffering for that. So we want to hear from you. Can you afford your prescription drugs? We're going to bring in a researcher who's been looking at the scope of the problem, and we'll look at possible solutions. That's Wednesday here on Maritime Noon. I'm Norma Lee McLeod. Thanks for listening today and for all your calls and emails, and let's talk again tomorrow.
Looking for more CBC podcasts? Go to cbc.ca/podcasting.